Welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Thursday, May 15th, we're studying 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 1 to 28. In today's text, the Lord answers Solomon's prayer, and he calls Solomon to continued faithfulness in worship of the one true God. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, the Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz. Pastor Kuntz serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Pastor Kuntz, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Hey, it is outstanding to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
So as we get started today, Pastor Kuntz, remind us where we are in 1 Kings as we prepare to look at chapter 9.
Yeah, you are well into Solomon's reign, and the temple has just been built as well as dedicated. So you are really practically at the height of Solomon's reign, both considered in the light of God's approval of what he's doing, of God's commandment to Solomon as king in Israel, but also just looked at politically. It will never get any better for the Israelites than it is right now. Significantly, nobody knows that except God. But that's where you are. It will really never get any better. And some of the conditions put on remaining where they are on this kind of beautiful mountaintop where we find ourselves today in 1 Kings 9, the conditions placed on that are going to be really crucial for how this chapter fits into the rest of the Bible.
Yeah, 1 Kings 8 was quite a high point, really, within the book of Kings and Israel's history up to this point. In the conversation we had yesterday in the latter half of Solomon's prayer, we noted a couple of similarities that exist between the way Solomon speaks there and some of the farewell speeches that are found in the scriptures, Moses in Deuteronomy, Joshua at the end of his book. And we kind of made the point, I don't know if it's too bad, but if that had been Solomon's farewell speech, this would have remained a high point in Solomon's reign. But he doesn't stop. And that's where this chapter serves as somewhat of a transition in the narrative of Solomon.
That's right. Yeah, because several little things as we read them this morning are going to set up just little tiny details, little hints, names, stuff like that. All that is to come because Solomon does not quit while he's ahead.
So reflect on that a little bit, and I imagine it'll come up more in our conversation, but this, we like to categorize the people in the scriptures as good guys or bad guys.
Yeah.
And we've seen this throughout. David, we saw it both in David, but maybe it's a little bit more magnified with Solomon. How does he get categorized, or what do we do with this reality that he is a sinner and a saint?
Yeah, and the good guys, bad guys thing, or white hats, black hats in terms of old Westerns that maybe you've seen, is not very helpful because as one undergraduate whom I taught the Bible in English to when I was in graduate school said, all these people are messed up. And so, very true. So what you're always dealing with is the same combination that you find in yourself when you read the scriptures. You find that those people as well are a mixture of good intentions and bad results, or bad intentions that are worked to good ends, in the case of Joseph's brothers, famously. And so the hero of the scriptures never needs to be anyone other than God. Solomon doesn't need to be a shining hero. David doesn't need to be a shining hero. Some people are, better than others. I don't actually think there's a question about that. Is it good that Isaac is the lone monogamous patriarch? Yeah, that's good. That's good. He doesn't have the problems that his father had with Hagar, for example. But they don't need to be purely amazing. And in Solomon, you find both great and amazing things, especially in this chapter, which is really the second glorious approval by the Lord of what Solomon is doing, as well as Solomon setting himself up for failure pretty much at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so let's go ahead and take a look here, beginning in 1 Kings 9, starting at the first verse. As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, The Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you will walk before me, as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, You shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight, and Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, Why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? Then they will say, Because they abandoned the Lord their God who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and laid hold on other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. I'll pause there at the end of verse 9. So talk a little bit about the timeline that's revealed here in the first verse there. This is after Solomon's building projects are over.
Right.
And then that's when the Lord comes again.
Yeah, this has been a matter of some years. So this is where you can tell the Bible does not narrate absolutely everything that ever happened. It's always going to give you what is significant in that person's life and that kingdom's history, whatever the case may be, for whomever the timeline is intended. And he's now appearing to Solomon a second time. The first time was at Gibeon in connection with Solomon's coming to power. This time now is in connection with the temples having been dedicated, the projects in Jerusalem having been completed. So the chapter starts in a very limited way, and the whole question and the conditional promise, this is not an absolute promise, but the conditional promise is a promise about a throne in Jerusalem. The throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. That's going to be exercised through the unconditional promise to David your father. But the problem here is that in that place, on that throne, there must be a man who is righteous. If a man should sit on that throne who is unrighteous, who does not walk as David walks, then everything may be overturned. And it's interesting that it moves, if you just think in terms of the geography, it moves from Jerusalem and the throne specifically that sits in the king's house near the house of the Lord, so that the Lord is in his place and the king is in his place. But if that king should prove unrighteous, then other nations will come. This house, both the house of the Lord now consecrated and the king's house, will be bereft. So this is a prediction of the very thing that Ezekiel's going to see, the glory of the Lord departing this temple. And Israel will no longer be there. That throne will be empty. The chair will be vacant. And other nations will then come in, and they will remember the beginning of the history of Israel. They will remember the Exodus there in chapter 9. But in remembering, that will only be to recall how they were unfaithful to the Lord, and the Lord brought all of this calamity on them because of their unfaithfulness, because of their unrighteousness.
So talk a little bit more about those two things standing side by side. On the one hand, you have the promise to David that was made that there will be a king in David's line forever. And I think you said that's unconditional.
Yeah.
But side by side here, you do have a conditional promise.
Right.
So help us distinguish those two things here and throughout the scriptures.
Yeah. So the unconditional promise is that one from David's line shall be on the throne. And much of Old Testament prophecy relies on that necessity. Because if something is unconditionally promised by God, then there is necessity behind it. It must be. So one from David's line must come. This is why the things promised to David are called sure mercies. Sure mercies. The conditional part is whether anyone in this specific, because remember, Solomon is not the only son of David. Now, he will be the ancestor of Christ, but he's not the only son of David, is that if you or your sons, Solomon, turn from following me, then you will be cut off. Okay, so then the question always must come when you're talking about who is the Messiah and who is David's son, also who is David's Lord, Jesus will ask. That question is a question about God will definitely find a man from David to rule, no question. Who is that righteous man, Psalm 24, who may enter in to God's presence? Who is that righteous man who may stand forever before the Lord? Because Solomon is standing now before the Lord, but there will come a time when he will forsake the Lord and then he will no longer stand.
What about the house of the Lord as it falls into? Because that's another big thing. Yep. Solomon has just prayed in chapter 8, and the Lord says, yeah, I'm going to put my name here. And then, by the way, if you forsake it, this house will be destroyed. So how does the house of the Lord figure into all?
Yeah, the Lord is always here and in the Gospels less impressed by his house than the people are. The people like to look at the house and say, oh, what great stones. And he says, I tell you that not one stone will be left standing upon another. So the Lord understands, both before and since his incarnation, that his presence with his people is dependent on his promises to them. Should they forsake his promises, his presence is no longer there. His graciousness is no longer there. So that has to do the being there with them. And Solomon has prayed for those mercies in chapter 8 very beautifully. Solomon is such a great speaker, such a wise man, right? But the presence of the Lord with his people does not depend on the wisdom of Solomon, which is the Lord's gift anyway. The presence of the Lord depends on the Lord having a people who have eyes to see and ears to hear. And if they stop those things up and become hard-hearted like Pharaoh, then he will forsake them.
It seems to me that within these words from the Lord, although he doesn't say what's going to happen, the fact that the great majority of the text deals with, but if you turn aside, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It sure sounds like the Lord is hat tipping there. This is the way things are going to go, is the latter half of the section.
And to call the chapter transitional, people might think of truck stops or off ramps or cloverleaf formations, other kind of transitional spaces in between where maybe there's some grass, but it's not well cut. This transitional in the scriptures usually fulfills something that has come before it in the story, but also sets up what will be fulfilled, what will come to pass later on in the story. And that's exactly what's happening, because the Lord shows them that I brought you here, and should you forsake me and embrace or lie down with, using some of the language there in verse 9 that you'll get in Hosea, where worship is something like a marriage, and utter faithfulness is therefore called for. Should you do that with other gods, you will be gone.
Talk more about what it means for Solomon to walk as David walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness. As we've already said a little bit, David's integrity of heart and uprightness was not always made manifest in moral living, noteworthy as 2 Samuel chapter 11. So what does that actually mean for Solomon
That's
to live
great.
Like that?
Yeah, a man after my own heart is a phrase that comes up often in connection with David, and the Lord says it, and he identifies him that way. So what does it mean? It doesn't have to do with a certain, like you say, it is not a kind of moral quality as if David is sinless, like the Lord is sinless. The Lord has many what are called in theology attributes. Right? He knows all things, he is holy, he is all-powerful. Those are different attributes of him. The attribute in question here is not his sinlessness or his perfection, because David doesn't have that. It seems rather to be that David has a lively awareness of the Lord's decrees or word, what the Lord has set forth, and therefore what must be. The best example that you can think of with that is that David does not kill his great antagonist who is seeking to kill him, Saul, because Saul has been anointed by God. So David's heart respects what God says and does. Solomon will, with time, lack that. Not every king to come after him will altogether lack that, but Solomon's heart will no longer be, you could say, integrated or one with the Lord's saying and doing. David is walking according to the Lord's saying and doing. Solomon will, after a time, no longer do. And the question of why that is, or how that is not actually explicitly answered in the scriptures, except through observing what Solomon does. Not all of that are we going to be able to see in this chapter, but the notion of walking helps you understand that this is not a pure question of David agrees with something that the Lord has said. It is also that David lives according to what the Lord has said, and Solomon will, with time, no longer do that.
And that walking, that living, is not only regarding the second table of the law,
right.
That is our righteousness toward our neighbor, but it especially applies to the first table of the law, the faith that we would have.
That's right. Yeah, it doesn't mean that David was nice or something.
More
like if David said, do you want to go out for dinner? He'd say, definitely, love to do it. Maybe not, I don't know. But yes, it means that in that person's life, he is living, it is a life of trust in the Lord, and therefore also a life according to the Lord. That's walking. And the Bible uses it all over the place, including in Proverbs, to talk about how to be wise. I say that to say that there is going to be a great irony in the fact that David is not particularly remembered as wise, even though he is praised as wise in the scriptures. Instead, Solomon is praised as wise, and what most of us actually mean by that is that he's smart, and that he knows a lot of stuff, but that's not quite the same thing as walking in wisdom.
So what is walking in wisdom?
Walking in wisdom doesn't require a certain amount of knowledge equal to Solomon's, although Solomon's knowledge is incredible and praiseworthy. That's good. David walks in wisdom because he understands that what the Lord has said. So the Lord has both anointed Saul as king and promised through his prophet that David shall be king. And David is wise enough to wait for the Lord to bring that to pass, not to force the issue on his own.
So you mentioned that we don't always get to see the why, the how of Solomon falling away, but we do see some of the things that he does. And I think in this section, perhaps something that he doesn't do, thinking back to the first time that the Lord appeared to Solomon, the one at Gibeon in 1 Kings 3, a large chunk of that text was Solomon's own prayer for wisdom. And we've just heard Solomon say a whole lot in 1 Kings chapter 8 in very beautiful, faithful words. It strikes me that in this text, Solomon doesn't say a thing in response.
Yeah, Solomon, that's because Solomon is busy. And I say that kind of as a joke, but not really. Solomon is busy doing so many things. He doesn't really have time to do stuff like pray at this point. I think that something that is readily seen as you go through Solomon's reign is a shift from a beginning where he's closely consulting David and is also trying to be merciful to whom he can be merciful. And he shifts instead with his great capacities, his great smarts, let's not say wisdom exactly, but he shifts to high activity, okay? And we're going to see some of that shortly. That activity doesn't particularly have a lot to do with anything that the Lord has in particular promised. And the first thing that he's going to do here in the very next paragraph has to, if you go far enough back, actually, he really is not within his rights to do this. And we'll explain why, but Solomon notably shifts from prayer, taking his time, so forth, to having a very high level of activity that makes him really the only king in Israelite history. You could make the case maybe that a couple of the guys from what will become the northern kingdom will maybe be his equal. Solomon is really the only Israelite king who could hold his own as a king, as a power in any way, with the nations around him. Everything else is small potatoes. Solomon is the only one who, in his own way, is a great king. The question is that actually what the Lord wants.
Yeah. I find it interesting that you say Solomon is too busy to say these things. Because
he's too busy to pray. I know a lot of people.
Well, but at the beginning of the text, it says that this was after Solomon had finished all these big building projects.
Yeah.
And my mind went to, in the narrative of David, when the Lord gives him rest from his enemies, or David gets in trouble in 2 Samuel chapter 11 when he doesn't do something, when he doesn't go out to war with his men. That's when he gets into trouble. And there's almost a, I don't know if there's exactly a parallel here with Solomon, but he's at a turning point, perhaps. Yeah. And he becomes too busy with the wrong things. And that proves to be his problem, as opposed to his father's problem, which was idleness at just that moment.
Yeah. And the question is, what does wrong mean? And from a certain perspective, right? So I guess what I'm saying is, there are all kinds of different ways to assess somebody's life. You can assess your own life in different ways. You can assess other people's lives in different ways. Historians grade American presidents and monarchs of different nations in various ways. Did they do what I wanted? Did they do what I would do? Whatever. Solomon is doing things and is about to do many of them that are praiseworthy in the sense of making in Israel a greater power among the kingdoms of the earth. You have to ask yourself, though, is that what they're for? Is that what they're supposed to be doing? And to walk after David's heart is not to ask yourself, what would be the most effective? What would be the most powerful move right now? Because David doesn't do that. David could and should, from this perspective, have killed Saul much earlier, could have taken the throne earlier, got to work earlier, settled things earlier. He doesn't do that because he doesn't believe it's within his rights, according to what God has said. It is not his to take Saul's life. So he doesn't. So he's got to wait. Solomon is not going to govern in that way. And everything that Solomon has done, basically up to verse 9, his dad told him to do. Okay, David wasn't allowed to build this stuff, so he said, Solomon, you do it. And that's how kings started. Now, from verse 10, we're getting into stuff that Solomon wants to do.
Yeah, thinking again about David, and there's a number of places in David's story, both before he becomes king and after he becomes king, where he is said to inquire of the Lord. You have these two marvelous accounts in 1 Kings where the Lord appears to Solomon and speaks to him and reveals to him. But I'm struggling to now think, I don't think there's a case where Solomon inquires of the Lord or initiates the prayer to the Lord other than in 1 Kings chapter 8.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't need to check back. He's got too much stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah. One more thing from this section that it transitions a little bit, but the role of the nations, particularly in the last part, that they're going to be the ones that are going to look at this. Israel will become a byword and the nations will be saying things about them. Talk a little about the role of the nations in that last section.
That's great. We don't really talk about this. I've read a lot of books of what's called missiology, the theology of missions, books about evangelism, books about starting new churches. Very few of them in my memory, it's not, maybe somebody wrote about this, but in my memory, nobody ever writes about this when they talk about missions. And that is, although you see it when you're doing evangelism in the wild, which is the Lord and his people already have a reputation among the nations. And that's easy enough to see, especially when you're trying to tell somebody about Christ or tell somebody about the church or whatever you may be telling them about. And they say something like, the church is full of hypocrites, or Jesus was a nice man, I don't need to be saved from my sins, or whatever they say. And what is being predicted in verse 8 and verse 9 is that the nations may not worship the Lord, the God of Israel, but they will know that he brought a people out of Egypt and that those people forsook their God. They will know that. It is part of understanding missions to know the things, both in this case true, and in other cases, maybe more often untrue, that the nations or those who are outside the household of faith know, whether mistaken or not, know about God and his people. Because God says they will know what I did for you and what you did to me.
And I guess there's a tragic irony and a pretty great sense of shame then.
Oh, yeah.
that the nations actually take the name of the Lord on their lips as Israel becomes a byword, and Israel is there because they wouldn't take
They're
the
talking
name
about
the Lord
everybody else besides the true God. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What's going to happen there is that the nations will know the Lord, the God of Israel, but they will not know him by faith. They will simply know him as one who was forsaken by his people.
So this is what the Lord tells Solomon there. The second time that he comes to him, how will Solomon respond in the rest of his reign? That's where the rest of chapter 9 will take us, and we will look at it on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Adam Kuntz this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Thursday, May 15th. We're studying 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 1 to 28 with the Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz. He serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Pastor Kuntz, prior to the break, we read and discussed verses 1 to 9. Now we pick up 1 Kings 9 at verse 10. At the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, and Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold, as much as he desired, King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. But when Hiram came from Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, they did not please him. Therefore he said, "What kind of cities are these that you have given me, my brother?" So they are called the land of Kabul to this day. Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. And we'll pause there at verse 14 to talk about this interaction between Solomon and Hiram, king of Tyre. Yeah. There's some history we probably need to review here, Pastor Kuntz, as well as maybe some just filling in some of the gaps of things that aren't quite expressed fully in these few verses. Remind us of who Hiram is and his relationship with Solomon thus far.
Yeah, this is the Bible's way, is that it does not, especially in the Old Testament, but because of the Old also in the New, it does not explain everything. It rewards you for rereading. That's where the payoff is. Because when you reread, you build up the details, and when you build up the details, you understand how much it's saying and how few words. The details here that matter are that during the time that Solomon has been carrying out these things, marked out near the end of David's reign and only fulfilled in his son's reign, he has had to interact with what is, in its way and beyond its geographic size, one of the most powerful, because it is the richest city-state, really, Tyre, with surrounding regions and affiliated cities, sometimes called Tyre and Sidon, northwest of Israel. And that's also a place in what is today Lebanon that has timber resources as well as trading networks to get gold that the Israelites don't have. And there are a couple different ways to think about this. You might think about Tyre as a very wealthy nation working with a much smaller nation or a much poorer nation, or Tyre as a place that has resources that other nation needs because it's just situated differently. Now, what's interesting here is that in verse 11, we get new information. Now, this was not envisioned by anybody, that in exchange somehow for the work that Hiram has done, that Solomon would pay in land. The reason that matters, and it's you hear Galilee and you think, oh, Galilee of the Gentiles, which it would be called later in the Old Testament and, of course, in the New Testament. But all of it belongs to Israel. And so what Solomon is doing in the whole scheme of the whole story is he's taking land that Israel should be settling, and he's turning it over to foreigners. In its way, it's actually worse than what Israel earlier did in Joshua and Judges, which was to enter the land but not really to conquer it. So he's going to give this away. Hiram, interestingly, has a different, let's say, appraisal of the real estate. Hiram, who can be choosier, comes and says, and we have this word kabul, meaning nothing or garbage or trash, dreck, right? Hiram says, this stuff is garbage. I don't want this land.
Can anything good come from Nazareth?
No, I don't. I don't want this stuff. It doesn't matter, right? Because it's mountainous land, and mountains might be pretty, but usually it's hard to grow stuff, and therefore it's hard to build wealth long term in mountainous regions. So after you get the resources, what really do you have left? So he doesn't want this, and he compensates Solomon for his trouble. But it wasn't really Solomon's, and this is such a great example of Solomon not walking after God's own heart. People will bring up the wives, they'll bring up the idolatry, they'll bring up the other stuff he's going to build for the wives in Jerusalem. Yeah, that's all a problem, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It's not one day Solomon woke up and said, boy, I really want to deal with 300 wives and 700 concubines. Okay, Solomon, long before that, in this case, was doing things and not really consulting the Lord. And in this way, Solomon has already stepped just a little farther than Saul, because if you remember Saul's similar errors, Saul would try to do something that seemed like the pious thing to do. So he offers a sacrifice when he should not have offered a sacrifice. Solomon doesn't really even stop and think. He's just making a deal. And so this, in its way, is worse than Saul already. If you see how the details build up, you can see that. If you don't, you're like, I don't even know why the Holy Spirit is telling me the stuff that he's telling me in verses 10 to 14. It matters a lot when you realize he's giving away things he shouldn't give away, because they are the Lord's places to put his people in.
And that way of looking at the land goes back into the books of Moses,
yep,
where the land is not the people's to do with as they please, but it's actually the inheritance that the Lord is giving them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So you can't just dispose of it. There are all these provisions in the law of Moses to make sure that, for example, if someone with title to a certain piece of land dies, here's how we handle that. Here's what we do if he only has daughters who are going to marry. All of that is the idea. This is the Lord's gift to you. You must inhabit it. It is not yours to say, I'm going to see if a Chinese investor wants to buy it, and then I'm going to jack the price up and he's going to buy it. You can't do that. It's not your land to sell.
And I know this isn't specified in the text, yeah, but you wonder if Solomon knows that this land isn't the most attractive part of Israel anyways, and if he's trying to get a little more than he should in this real estate transaction, Hiram calls and want it.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. I am not sure about that. It's the land, it doesn't specify if it's in the upper or the lower Galilee. I'm assuming it's in the upper Galilee because that's closer to Tyre.
Sure.
But none of it is particular. I don't think he particularly needs it. And if you do a deep dive on the tribes of Dan and Asher and Naphtali, those are all obscure tribes for a reason. Nobody really cares about these 20 cities. But yeah, he does make some money off of it. So, you know, he's got that going for him.
Sure. And I guess the only reason I think that a little bit is because the previous time Hiram's words are recorded, at least in great detail, he's very positive toward Solomon.
Yeah.
And here it's one of those places where, again, and it doesn't, like verse 13, he said, did this come by message? Was it a face-to-face thing that he said? It sounds pretty formal, but you wonder what's behind that simple, what are you trying to pull on me here, buddy? Something like that. And again, I might be reading more into it than is there. But previously, Solomon and Hiram have had a fairly close relationship
with each other,
going back to David.
Yeah.
This seems to put a little bit of distance between them.
Yeah, it is distance. And whether it is intentionally trying to get one over on Hiram or Huram, as he gets called in Chronicles, or whether it is an instance of Solomon really not knowing what he has, not knowing the value of what he has. And Hiram and the Tyrians or the Phoenicians generally as a group of people are going to have a wider acquaintance with things.
Yeah.
And so Hiram may just have a more realistic assessment of what the land is really worth. Solomon doesn't really know this kind of a thing because they're not yet themselves a seafaring people.
Sure. And then maybe then the bigger point, regardless of what Solomon does or doesn't think, is that he doesn't recognize the wealth of this land in the reality that God is the one that has given it to his people as the inheritance. And that's where the true value is found. And if he realized that and believed that, he wouldn't be trying to sell it off to Tyre in the first place.
He doesn't even have the right. It's, I don't know where you live, Pastor Apple, exactly. I don't know if you live in a even if you live in a parsonage, the idea works. But I can't just come to your town and say, I'm selling the Apple's house. I can't do that. It's either owned by them or their congregation or whoever it's owned by. But I can't do that because I have no right to sell the house that you live in. And that's what Solomon is doing here.
Yeah, that's right. And that theme, again, goes back to the Pentateuch, and it continues forward. There's other accounts in the Kings, notably under Ahab, where this same thought comes up and is missed by future kings, just like it is missed here by Solomon. So, again, thinking about the transitional nature of this chapter, the Lord has said to Solomon, if you will walk in these ways, thus far Solomon's walking is... There's a bit of missteps here, to put it mildly. Let's see how he continues.
Yeah.
Verse 15 now. And this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house and the Milo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city and had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer and Lower Beth Horon and Baaloth and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah. And all the store cities that Solomon had, and the cities for his chariots, and the cities for his horsemen, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. All the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the people of Israel, their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were unable to devote to destruction, these Solomon drafted to be slaves, and so they are to this day. But of the people of Israel, Solomon made no slaves. They were the soldiers, they were his officials, his commanders, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. These were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550 who had charge of the people who carried on the work. But Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. Then he built the Milo. Three times a year, Solomon used to offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he built to the Lord, making offerings with it before the Lord. So he finished the house. King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea, in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon. That takes us to the end of 1 Kings chapter 9. There's a variety of material here. Pastor Kuntz, let's talk about the matter of forced labor, these varieties of cities that are mentioned, the fact that the forced labor comes from these various Canaanite groups, but not the people of Israel. There's a number of details in that section.
Yeah, and I know that it feels like a grab bag to the listeners. It really is not, and it's helpful if you have two things in front of you in addition to the text of the Bible when you're studying especially something like this. One is an atlas, a good Bible atlas, that shows you at least people's best guess if they don't exactly know, like, where exactly is Ophir, okay? In addition to that, the other thing to have would be a concordance whether that's on your phone or whether that's a printed concordance or whatever it is, so that you can see other places that these things have appeared and jump quickly. And you can see, for instance, where else have I gotten lists like the list in verse 20, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, or often rather than Perizzites in that list, you get Canaanites, and the Canaanites come first. Who are these people? What was supposed to happen to them is that they were supposed to have been what is called devoted to destruction. That's what happens, for instance, to the city of Jericho. Okay. And that judgment on those peoples has to do with the curse of Noah, all the way back in Genesis 9, on Canaan, and with their idolatry, their practice of idolatry, the incoming of the people of Israel from the perspective of the people already in the land is a judgment of God on their idolatry. There are not supposed to be any people there. Okay, so Solomon doesn't really, it doesn't seem like it even enters his mind to do that, to carry on the, this would be to carry on the work of Joshua. Okay, and to be fair to Solomon, he's not unique in not taking up the work of Joshua. It hasn't been done since Joshua's time.
It hasn't happened since the generation of
Joshua,
essentially.
Exactly, yeah. So it's been a long time. I'm just saying, it's not like he goes back and says, okay, here's what we're supposed to do with these people, or at least we need to get them out of the land. Whatever the case is, he doesn't take up Joshua's work. Instead, he does something, and this is where the translation in verse 15, as well as in verse 21, 22, as a noun, no forced laborers. Bible translators will often not say slave or slavery because they don't want the reader to think that it's perpetual and race-based, similar to American slavery up to the time of the Civil War. So that's why they say something like forced labor. But it's not particularly helpful because forced labor sounds like Solomon just grabbed them and you guys have to work for me for 3 months and then you're free to go. It doesn't seem like that's what happened. It seems like he made these, they're not really different races necessarily, but certainly ethnicities. It seems like he did make them slaves, okay? And what his vision here is that therefore I get this just free. I don't have to pay them to work. I have to feed them. I get this free labor force, and that's how I'm going to get all of this stuff done. And in this way, Solomon is a totally normal ancient king. I didn't say good, but I said normal, okay? Yeah. So he's taking something that has a different intention in the Lord's commandment for Israel, and he's going to make it a very economically feasible thing that he can get all of this building done by doing to these groups what was done to the Israelites in Egypt. That's the idea. This group will, in perpetuity, now be slaves. That's the idea. And the Israelites then don't actually build their own stuff. And it's because he does this is probably why he gets all of this building done. Despite the fact that some of his cities, and some of them are new cities, and then some of them, they get called cities in the scriptures, and that's a correct translation, like in verse 19. But one way to think about them is that some of them are almost more like military bases. Okay. But he gets all of this building done because he has all of these people working for free. The Israelites are not really doing the building. You can see that in verse 22 and 23, the Israelites have morphed not into kind of independent men with their own homesteads in Israel. Instead, many of them have become a kind of upper class over this slave class of these other ethnicities who are not Israelites. Now, that's not the Lord's plan. The Lord's plan was they're all going to have their own piece of land, even the Levites, throughout Israel. But Solomon wants to build a kingdom that is legitimately impressive and wealthy and powerful, and this is the way everybody else does it.
That, the way you've described this, reminds me again of an incident in King Saul's reign.
Yeah.
When in 1 Samuel 15, he spares Agag, the king of Amalek, and he doesn't kill all of the Amalekites like he's supposed to. And Samuel comes and says, why do I hear the bleating of goats?
Yep.
And he's I'm going to save the best for the Lord. And he's got a very pious sounding reason for disobeying the Lord. It would seem in the background of this, Solomon has a very pious reason for not obeying the Lord.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that there is, a tremendous amount of room in anybody's life for a difference between what he is doing and how he is explaining that to himself. Yeah. And it's fairly easy for anybody with a knowledge of the Bible, and his actions make you think, it doesn't mean he didn't know the Bible, but his actions make you think, did he consult the Bible at all before he did any of this?
Yeah, that's where, like, why didn't the command to Joshua to take care of these people, to devote them to destruction,
right,
that's given over 400 years ago at this point. Does it still apply? Solomon doesn't even bother to ask.
No.
And that, yeah.
No. And later on in Israel's history, it's actually going to be pretty rare that there will be a king who will consult the scriptures. Now, when that happens, you will find out shocking things. Like I teach a Zoom Bible study to my people on Wednesday nights. Very interesting. We're doing Exodus right now. I think some of them were surprised to hear after the Passover happens for maybe 200 years after it gets instituted, then it doesn't happen again until Josiah's times. So nobody's really bothering to find out what's in the Bible. And so Solomon has a pretty good plan, I think, economically and militarily, but because his plan does not align with the Lord, it's going to fail. And I don't really know if he knows that. If he does know it, he certainly doesn't seem to be worried about it. It's possible that he doesn't even know it, because his plan is just made according to the world's plans.
Okay, we've come through about verse 21. As you said, it can seem a little scattershot here, but these things are related. Take us into several details. Pharaoh's daughter, Solomon's worship life, the ships that he built and sent forth.
I like boats, so we'll save the boats for last.
Okay.
But what's happening as of verse 22 and 23 is that the people are, just like Samuel said they would be, they're now finding their life's purpose, as well as obviously where their paycheck is coming from, the king, rather than from the land the Lord has given them, which was the plan. In addition to that, Solomon has made a permanent union, a marriage with Pharaoh's daughter. Now, that has its own reason. So this is where, if I'm Solomon thinking just purely diplomatically or in terms of power politics, if this guy is objectively much wealthier and larger than I am, and that's Egypt, they're squeezed on the west by Egypt and on the east by whatever the Assyrians or Babylonians are at the time, that I need to make a lasting peace by marrying his daughter. What's going to happen then is that she gets her own palace in the land. And this is the beginning of the idolatry. Not that there is yet a temple, but that it's not indicated, like, is she a believer? It's fine to marry an Egyptian. Moses married an Egyptian, but Moses' wife became a believer in the true God. Is that happening now? In addition to that, the Millo is a building, it seems like, on the southwest side of Jerusalem that is being built up, and it almost like a fortress if you look at the other references to it. So what you can see is that there are still more building projects going on in Jerusalem. And if I can make this comparison, one way to think about this is that King Herod the Great also has much building going on in Jerusalem. And King Herod the Great also is, at least publicly, as Solomon is in verse 25, a pious Jew. We don't remember Herod the Great in the same way that we remember Solomon. But I think that's partly because we are not picking up on the details that the Bible is offering. Yes, in a way that feels like a random list, but is very much not if you're following the scriptures, that tell you all of these little details. That Solomon is very much about aggrandizement. He is about lasting military and diplomatic solution to Israel's just being small and therefore insecure. Small number of people, small country, not particularly fertile. So he's fixing those problems, as it were. But this is not actually what the Lord wants him to do. Okay? Mm. And so he has now, I think really from verse 10 in this chapter, I think this chapter is very important, he has now begun to govern in the way that is according to his own heart. This is not, however, according to the Lord's heart. That pains me to say specifically about boats, because I think boats are just cool, and I think it's cool that Solomon...
At least he's going to church three times a year, though.
He is going to church three times a year, so...
Christmas, Easter, and once else.
He just a random Sunday in August or something.
Sorry, talk to us about boats.
No, you're good. I'm just thinking about which congregations he would be considered as self-excluded and which he's a member in good standing. Depends on the Constitution, right? Solomon builds... a fleet. Now, this is particularly interesting because, and he has to build it where he does, and you can see if you look into these things, that the very same location is a major location for the Israeli Navy to this day, because Israel doesn't have on its main Mediterranean coast hardly anything of use for seagoing vessels. Very few natural harbors. So he's going to build this to the south. There is great difficulty in doing this because you have to cross the Negev Desert to get there. So one other thing to conceive of with Solomon, and I skipped over the chariots, but the chariots are one way to think about this, is that things like chariots or building a seaport on the other side of the desert from where your population base actually lies, these are very impressive feats technologically. Okay. A chariot is something like a tank, or we could say in terms of very modern warfare, highly sophisticated drones or anti-aircraft batteries. And the seaport thing is very impressive, and he's the only Israelite that pulls this off. Okay. The question is, does the Lord want this? Now, the reason he does it, and the location Ophir in verse 28 is not entirely clear. Most people figure it's somewhere in East Africa, and I think that's probably the best bet, is that he's doing this to set up a means of supplying gold to the country. He's going to have to split some of this with his friend Hiram, with whom he's working, because the Phoenicians, the Tyrians, know the ocean. So they help him get all of this set up. But the reason Solomon does it is to establish an ongoing flow of enduring value to Israel. Again, the question has to come, does God want Israel to be full of gold and silver? And no. You might think, hey, it's the love of money that's the root of evil. And that's true. That's what the scriptures say. But the issue here is, what do they need that for? Right? So whenever there's stuff, and Solomon has plenty of stuff, and he has plenty of smarts, the question is never in the scriptures, is the stuff bad or good? The question is, what are you going to do with all that stuff? And what Solomon's going to do with this flow of gold, and silver will become like nothing in his days. That detail is yet to come. This is going to beef up his reign, his rule, and it will be a source of wealth. I don't see many people think much about this, but you got to think of it sometime. This is going to be a source of wealth for this dynasty for time to come. Solomon is building up reserves that will enable him to maintain control, because he doesn't need the gold for decorative purposes. That's all done already. This is a store of wealth similar to a central bank purchasing gold or something like that in order to help maintain stability and control. The issue is Israel doesn't depend on chariots. His pleasure is not in the legs, the strength of a horse, nor is it in the legs of a man. Israel does not depend on these very human earthly factors the way that Solomon is governing Israel.
This would be a good place, if you haven't done so, it would be a good time to look back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, where Moses gives the commands for the kings, and see how many of them Solomon goes against. He doesn't read the Bible regularly. He's acquiring gold. He's got chariots and horsemen. He's going down to Egypt. He pretty much checks off all the things that he wasn't supposed to do. So again, just as you said, the reward is in rereading the Bible. If you haven't reread that in this part of 1 Kings yet, do so, because you're going to see these things go forward. That's about where our text comes to an end today, Dr. Kuntz. And we've got about a minute here on the morning. As we reflected on this, and we're starting to see how Solomon is not going to be faithful as the Lord has called him to be, what do we take from this chapter, and how does it push us forward to Christ?
Christ is very self-consciously, despite the fact that he doesn't seemingly have any gold to his name, he is a king after the Lord's own heart. He actually governs the way that a king should. And that concerns what he cares about, what he loves, where he leaves his legacy. All of that will be according to the Father's commandment. So I think it might be very profound to just jump from our text to, say, John 17, and just see how this descendant of Solomon, the true king, prays on the night in which he was betrayed.
The Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. He's been helping us today to study 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 1 to 28. Reverend Kuntz, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about 1 Kings 9, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we read 1 Kings chapter 10. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.